This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. Our regular contributors, Iowa State University political science professor Stefan Schmidt and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson, will be our guests. They'll talk about a number of issues that have bubbled up this week, and we'll also take your phone calls and emails. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. Politics Day with Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson is coming up next after this check of news from National Public Radio and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Wednesday, Politics Day. That means Stefan Schmidt, political science professor from Iowa State University, is with us in our studio in Ames. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political pundit,
whatever,
analyst, person about the country, is with us as well. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning. It's actually snowing in New Hampshire.
Oh, my gosh.
So I just want to let you know, there isn't such a thing as global warming. We have snow here, honey.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sunny but a little chilly in Iowa today.
Oh, good. I feel better.
So right now, President Obama is probably still in Iowa on his way to Missouri. He held a town hall meeting in Ottumwa last night. Also was in Fort Madison at a wind energy manufacturing plant. Part of what the White House is calling the White House to Main Street tour. Steph, Arnie, can you both... What's behind the president's motivation? What do you think he's trying to accomplish? And do you think he'll accomplish it with this tour?
Stefan, you go first because I want to be funny.
Okay. and you are funny, and I'm never funny. So here we go. The Obama has had an interesting approach to leadership. And that was that he took some of the biggest challenges, such as healthcare reform, and he basically asked Congress to come up with a healthcare reform package, a bill that would address some of the issues. And then he let them fight among themselves. And then in the end, he came in and said, I think we've got it as much as we can get here on for both the liberals in the Democratic Party. We're never going to get Republicans on board, so let's stick with this and not make the mistake that Richard Nixon made with Ted Kennedy, where Ted Kennedy said, I don't want it because it's not perfect. And then he suddenly, changed to now selling what he had concocted. And I think he's on a tour to raise confidence in himself, to challenge the Republicans for not having come up with any alternatives and having essentially... missed every opportunity to be part of this as far as he's concerned. And so I think he is using the bully pulpit, which is very effective. Remember, Ronald Reagan was able to bypass Congress, was able to bypass interest groups and lobbyists and go directly to public opinion and boost that up. And I think that is what Obama is trying to do, is he's trying to pick those numbers up, trying to put the Republicans in a tough spot, and doing it by going to places where he doesn't necessarily have a natural constituency, because Iowa is a very divided state, Democrats, Republicans, independents. It can go either for a Democrat or a Republican in presidential elections. And it gives him a chance to have in the backdrop not the normal people that the Republicans are trying to say are his supporters, Hispanics, blacks, poor, urban and so on, but instead small town people. And I think it's an interesting strategy.
Okay,
Arnie.
I see President Obama as being a quick study, so I guess the good news is he did not ask for the price of arugula at a Whole Foods store this time, but instead is eating rhubarb pie. So I do see that there has been a change. But more than the rhubarb pie, I think, Stefan, one of the things that President Obama realizes is that greed trumps health. And that is that part of the reason why he had a hands-off strategy on health care reform is that he saw the mistake of Hillary Clinton, who was too ambitious, who was too authoritarian, and thought she knew better than all the 100 egos in the United States Senate, that she could just deliver a plan to them and they would say, yes, mistress, whatever you want. Mm-hmm. The problem was that while it was true that Hillary Clinton made a mistake, Barack Obama made a mistake with health care because he didn't realize that the plunging economy would make him look like he was off message, that he was not focused. He let health care really sort of wander off the reservation, become demonized, become, you know, turned into, you know, death panels as opposed to health panels. And I think he learned a lesson that he needed to be much more front and center and use the bully pulpit to explain to the American people that health care wasn't just about health, but it was about the economy and was about jobs. The good news about Wall Street is that nobody likes them, nobody's ever been there, and they really hate the greedy SOBs. So I think what's happening is that as they see the economy go to hell in a handbasket, suddenly they realize that the only people that were making money, even as the economy was tanking, turns out to be people like Goldman Sachs. I mean, even if millionaires lost a million, they still had 15 million left. But when people lose their jobs, they have nothing. They're losing their homes. They're losing their pensions. They're losing their stability. And that seems to never quite happen on Wall Street. So I think what's really clear is he wants to go to Main Street. He wants to go to Middle America. He wants to go to the places that have never even been close to Wall Street and explain to them, I am on your side. I am going to fight the big boys. I'm going to fight the greed. I'm going to try to bring this down because their greed not only hurt you, but it hurt the economy and it hurt the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's got to sell this package. But the sad thing is about all of this, Jonathan, is that if you ever do sort of a financial IQ of how sophisticated Americans are about their own finances, let alone the finances of their state or the finances of their country, we would all flunk. So I think there's a dilemma here. It's very easy to demonize because none of us really understand really what's going on in our own financial world, let alone these world of derivatives and sub-collateral loans and everything else they're doing. So it becomes really problematic because he can demonize easily, but also how do you find a solution that both addresses the greed of Wall Street but doesn't undermine the economy that has become so wedded to Wall Street? It's a real fine dance he's got to walk.
We'd love to get a call or an email from someone who might have been at the president's either the town hall meeting in Ottumwa or at the speech in Fort Madison. If that's you, please give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Arnie, are you suggesting that the president's taking the Leo DeRocher approach where you unite people by focusing on the common enemy?
It's the common enemy that is, I mean, you know, it's something that's easy to explain. Goldman Sachs did, I don't think, it didn't help itself yesterday, but it didn't hurt itself yesterday because they're already hated. I mean, how much more hatred can you have than what already exists, you know, on the street about Goldman Sachs? And even people have decided, even if it turns out that they didn't have a fiduciary duty to their clients, which they can't believe, even if it turns out that they didn't do anything illegal, what they did was so outrageous that it needs to change. And whether that means that we have to rewrite the laws, whether it means that we have to, you know, shrink the size of big banks, what they know is that the behavior was wrong. You wouldn't do it in your own family. You wouldn't do it in your own business. God help us. Why are they allowed to do it on Wall Street?
Stefan, is this going to work? Is it, the economy's rough and we're very polarized on health care reform. But look at those guys. They're rich at your expense. Is that going to work?
Well, I think you don't have to really tell people that. I think people have been watching neighborhoods in their communities declining while McMansions pop up like mushrooms all over the place that are, to some extent, unnecessarily gaudy and large, and at the same time that the income gap between the upper 1% and the lower 40% has grown more in the last 10 or 15 years than in much of our history. And people know that. They can feel it. They can see it. And to see a bunch of very wealthy, arrogant cocky men. There were not very many women involved in these Wall Street dealings. Not even understand what the problem is or what the question is. Speaks for itself. I think the Democrats don't have to do very much. The Republicans, on the other hand, really need to ask themselves whether they want to be identified as the ones on the side of these guys. You know, the Republican Party used to be the party of big business. That was always the way it was. And the Democrats were the party of the little guy in Main Street and, you know, the working class. And somehow that changed a little bit. But there is now, I think, a huge risk to Republicans that they will, in fact, be tagged as the party of big business, and in this case, big banking business. And I think that could be very bad for them between now and November, when the election is. A lot of things can happen. And the polls right now look like they're not very good for the Democrats. But unless the Republicans get on board on some sort of regulatory regime that puts an end to these risky practices, which are a danger to—they're a danger to the national security of the United States.
They are.
You know,
exactly,
they're going to be on the wrong
national
side
security.
Of it. It is. It's national security.
Argument. You're absolutely right. And there's a wonderful article today, Financial Times, Martin Wolf. I sent you my quote of the day, and he's talking about this is not a time for tepid regulation. This is a time where you must be aggressive. The American people get it. They understand it. They are ready for it. They don't need to understand. What they understand is a half a loaf is not enough. But listen to what Martin Wolf says. As John Kenneth Galbraith used to write, Bezel, the stock of embezzlement, was always rising in good times. But the real catastrophe is the risk taken on by the gamblers working legally inside the machine. The role of big institutions is problematic. They are, at one and the same time, the house, the biggest players at the gambling tables, agent for the other players, and if all goes wrong, beneficiaries of limited liability and implicit and explicit government bailouts. Think about this. They're the house, they're the biggest players, they're the agent for the players. Think about what Martin just described. How can that be legit? How can that be legit? I mean, right there, that's got to smell, and that has to basically undermine a strong, vibrant economy that we can all benefit from.
So, but do we think this is going to get traction? Because, you know, at some level, President Obama was the one who spearheaded a lot of these bailouts. And now he's the one who's saying, who's calling the people that he helped bail out, the boogeyman. So can he do that?
Yes. And I remember when the bailout started, we were doing radio already then. Radio had been invented. And everybody said, why are they doing this? Why don't they just punish them and so on? And I said, I'll tell you why. And at the end of this little break, I'll tell you what I said.
You know, Stefan, that is great forward promotion.
Isn't that
like
how you guys always do this?
When we luck out.
We'll be back in a second with the right answer.
I've got 10 seconds to tell you that this is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Calls and emails, especially if you saw the president, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Stefan Schmidt, Arnie Arneson talking about politics, your phone calls and emails. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. Would especially like to hear from people who were at one of the president's addresses in Iowa yesterday, either Ottumwa or Fort Madison. Stefan, you were going to give us the correct answer.
The reason Obama did not begin to wield the aluminum baseball bat on the Wall Street crowd early on is because he realized they were, in fact, the drunk pilot sitting in the cockpit, and they needed to sober him up and get the plane landed first.
Exactly.
Then you can start beating up the pilot, fire him, you know, tear out his wings and whatever. And that's what he's doing now. In other words, they had to rescue this banking system on which we all depend without even knowing it. You know, we go about every day in our business and we think we are masters of our own life, and we're not. We are, in fact, little puppets being manipulated by an enormous machine that manages all of the finances, all the credit, all the prosperity around us. And that machine is largely concentrated in Wall Street. And once that was stabilized and the banks, you know, were able to stand up again because the alcohol had worn off, now's the time to bring them in and say, okay, guys, we picked you up out of the gutter and we cleaned you up and gave you coffee and changed your clothes. And now you're going to pay for this and we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. And it was the way it had to be done. It's because like otherwise the economy would have collapsed.
It's like the reverse of basic training where they knock you down to build you up.
Right.
He had to build you up to knock you down.
Absolutely.
Let's go
Absolutely.
To the phones. Denise from Fairfield saw the president yesterday. Denise, where did you see him?
I saw him in Ottumwa.
And what was your take on that?
I thought it was a clear and inspiring meeting. And I also was encouraged by how the crowd did. And people in America are pretty smart, and I'm hoping that they continue to be educated and be smart enough to understand that we need reform, and that people who stand in the way of it are not working in our interests. I mean,
Denise, did you go into that meeting as an Obama supporter?
Yes, I did. I did,
okay.
But I also have been. You know, I haven't stood behind every single thing that has gone on in his administration, because I have also voted independent before. But I think what I'm excited about is that we've got someone who is intelligent and who thinks things through and who looks at the big picture, who really is taking on these difficult issues and not just sitting back and saying, well, let it ride, you know.
Denise, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments.
Doesn't it scare you that the people at Goldman Sachs are intelligent too? I mean, intelligence alone is not enough, and I hope that Obama is intelligent and separated enough from Wall Street, because a lot of the players surrounding Barack Obama worked at Goldman Sachs or had a relationship with Goldman Sachs or have a contact with Wall Street and are giving him some guidance. And these people on Wall Street were intelligent too. But intelligence and greed can also create this noxious problem we saw happening on Wall Street. And can Barack Obama make sure that the regulations that he embraces really do address some of the underlying failures? And someone suggested, for example, that if you give people bonuses on Wall Street, those bonuses are for stock that can't be, you know, turned into cash for 5 years after you get the bonus, so that people suddenly start realizing that they have to be in this for the long term. Can we start creating certain things that will make people feel like they own the situation or the concept that they sold, so they can't just walk away, make a fortune, and then everyone else gets sacrificed? I'm just hoping that we can be smart and we can be ethical.
Well, Al Capone was really smart, too.
Exactly.
But eventually, taxes got him too. Let's go to Steve in Ottumwa. Steve, you were at the town hall meeting there at Indian Hills yesterday.
Yes, I was.
And your impression?
Well, it was really a wonderful event. I'm a big Obama supporter, but I think he picked Ottumwa because it's a labor town that generally votes Democratic, so he was fairly sure he'd have a warm audience. And also, we got a large TARP. Grant, I guess, for our Job Corps Center. So people were going to be receptive to what he had to say, and they were.
Steve, has your support for the president remained consistent, or has it changed over the last year or so?
Oh, it's been pretty consistent. Now, there's a couple of things he's done. I wasn't big on the offshore drilling and pro-nuclear.
Now we know why. Now we know why you weren't big on the offshore drilling.
They're going to burn it, I think.
I wrote an op-ed piece on this just yesterday for Insider Iowa, and you know, we all knew that it was very high risk, which is why all the governors along the coastal states weren't real excited about having offshore drilling off their coast, and now we understand. So
right.
Good
but
for you for being skeptical.
I support most of what he's done, especially the health care plan and the TARP plan.
Steve, do you see any contradiction in the president having been the big advocate for a lot of the Wall Street bailout and now turning his attention to criticizing those same people that he bailed out?
No, I think politicians got to be flexible, and obviously Wall Street played a big role in our financial collapse, so they got to be dealt with.
Steve, thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it. Let's do one more here. Jack from Davenport is on the line. Jack, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call. You guys are the favorite political show on radio, bar none, local, national. I think you guys are tops. Having said,
now we're gonna get it.
I want to remind you that President Obama had a meeting with the bankers last year. Yeah. And what was said at that meeting? What was the takeaway from that meeting? I am the only thing that is standing between you and the pitchforks, right?
Mm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And what did the masters of the universe think when President Obama, brand new President Obama, said that? Oh, this court, we're going to take care of this guy. Who does he think he is? Well, guess what? This mess will extract loan modifications. It will loosen up credit. That will be the penance that these guys will have to pay. And I'd like to hear your comments.
Thanks, Jack. We appreciate it. Arnie, Stefan, what do you think of that? Those are some interesting observations from Jack.
Well, you know, here's the interesting. I think the 2010 election is going to be very interesting because the largest sort of financial institutions that support, you know, Congress are the banks. I mean, who said, you know, the banks own this place? And so I think the banks thought that, you know, if Barack Obama thought that somehow he was going to, like, be in between them and the pitchforks, that they controlled Congress anyway, Dodd was in their pocket, Schumer was in their pocket. And I think what you forget is that when you buy a politician, somebody can always raise the price. And what's ironic is the banks raised their own price by failing so miserably, by having emails that referred to the products they were selling as a word I can't use because you'll blip me. And I think what's happened is that the American people are now in a position to buy their politicians back. Isn't it ironic? Yes, the banks do control Congress, but there's actually a higher price. And it turns out that I think the American people are now commanding the higher price because their outrage is almost nuclear at this point.
I mean, he did, in fact, in a way, have to do what he did in the early step, which is to say, you know, I will try to make sure that your institutions don't collapse. And I know there's a lot of public anger out there and people really are foaming at the mouth. But, you know, we'll work with you. He had to do that because we can't live without the banking system. And when we say too big to fail, that's just not some idle phrase. It is, in fact, the banking system of this country cannot fail. And if it does, we're all screwed. And so he had to, you know, do that. And they didn't understand, because he didn't say it, I am temporarily putting myself between you and the pitchforks. And he's now stepped off to the side and said, you know, come and get him. And the pitchforks are out there. Now, the Tea Party movement hasn't seemed to target this in particular. They're outrages about other things. But there are a lot of other angry people out there who are not protesting like this, who are really, really mad. And they're going to vote in November.
We'll talk a little bit more about financial reform, and we'll also get to the state of Arizona, immigration, and birth certificates. That's coming up when Talk of Iowa continues in just a moment here on Iowa Public Radio. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests. You can comment as well, 866-780-9100, or talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's 10:30. We'll be back in just a bit.
Are subsidies for corn ethanol still needed? This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. President Obama's visit to America's Corn Belt brings a tough debate about ethanol's future to the surface. Sean Ali has been looking at this. So, Sean, what's the debate?
Well, Congress is looking to cut the federal budget, as you might know, and one target is this key ethanol subsidy. It's a tax credit, and it's worth about $4.5 billion, and it runs out by the end of the year. Ethanol trade groups, as you might suspect, are fighting to extend this credit. And I talked to Tom Bias. He's CEO of Growth Energy. And he tells me we're spending plenty of money for overseas oil, right? So why not support homegrown ethanol?
We create jobs that can't be outsourced. You know, I don't know why we want to fund the economies of foreign governments. We should be looking at spurring our own economic development here in the United States.
Last year, the Government Accountability Office questioned whether we even need this particular tax credit, since the government requires gasoline refiners to blend in billions of gallons of ethanol anyway.
So with no subsidy for ethanol, does that mean gasohol prices might be more expensive in the future?
You know, no one's really sure yet, because ethanol prices usually follow the cost of oil, and that's been going up, but no one knows how far it's going to go.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
All right. Take care, Lester.
This is the Environment Report. GreenInvasion.tv's Matt Grokoff is trying to make his home the oldest net-zero energy house in America, and he asked me to come over for his latest project. The note on Matt's door told me to come on in and head for the basement. Matt is spraying expanding foam insulation up in that area where the floor framing sits on the foundation. The sill plate, which is basically nothing more than 1.5 inches of wood between the inside of your home and the great outdoors.
There's no insulation between your house, where you're living part, and the foundation itself.
Maybe you've been in a basement of an old house, and sometimes you can actually see daylight through the sill plate in places. Those leaks need to be sealed. That could be done with caulk. Then the area needs to be insulated. That could be done with fiberglass insulation.
What we decided to do both at the same time, seal and insulate, was use a do-it-yourself spray foam insulation kit from Tiger Foam. There's plenty of it professionals out there, and for most people, that's what I'd recommend you do. Go to the professional. If money is an issue, or if you're a really handy person, these spray foam kits are fantastic.
The foam insulation kit costs about $300. It's basically two tanks, each about the size of a propane tank you'd use for an outdoor grill. A hose from each tank is attached to a spray gun that mixes the chemicals. They spray out, and they make a sticky foam that expands into nooks and crannies and then hardens after several minutes.
Way easier than I ever thought they were going to be, by the way.
You still end up with a goof, though.
I did have a goof. There is a little bit of foam there dripping when I forgot to turn on one of the canisters. But what do you... Come on, Lester.
Matt's goof means he's got to wipe up some of the mess and spray again, but it's not a disaster. Right now, there are federal tax credits for spray foam insulation, 30% up to $1,500. That credit's limited to the material, not the labor if you hire a professional. Some states and even municipalities are considering additional incentives. One final note, to use the spray foam, Matt Grokoff is decked out in a white hazmat suit. He's got latex gloves on, goggles, a respirator.
You've got to take all the safety precautions. You've got to wear your goggles, your suit, and it also can be messy, too. Any overspray and stuff that gets in your hair will stay in your hair.
And as he zips up, I get the hint, Matt has to get back to work.
I do. I've got 30 seconds before this nozzle sets up. So, Lester, thanks again.
All right. Sounds like my cue to get out of here. That's Matt Grokoff with GreenInnovation.tv. I'm Lester Graham with the Environment Report.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All. It's our Wednesday Politics Day. Arnie Arneson and Stefan Schmidt are our guests. We've been talking about financial reform. Coming up in just a moment, we will talk about the state of Arizona and what's going on there with some legislation regarding immigration and proving that you're a citizen to get on the ballot. That's coming up in just a second. Let's start with one more phone call on financial reform. Mark from Des Moines is on the line. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well, sir. Your question or comment?
My question is from an old man. I was born with lamps had wicks in them. I have seen these cycles go on clear back through history, clear back to Pharaoh's day in the pyramids. Like the financing of this exploration of this country when Columbus came over here, the Teapot Dome, the breaking up of the trusts, the savings and loan. And I'd like Arnie's comments on this. When are we, as supposedly smart people, ever going to learn this stuff doesn't work?
Well, you know what? I think we never will. I think that that's one of the reasons why you have a pull me, push me kind of situation, where one of the things that the bankers need is they need regulators. Because it turns out that they were not fiduciaries. They did not exercise the public good when they realized they could make money. You know, can I share something with you? My brother went into banking,
And all his friends at law school went into securities and real estate and everything else because they wanted to make a lot of money. And my brother wanted a regular, safe, secure job that got him sort of comfortable but not rich. That changed dramatically when we created non-banks and deregulation and derivatives. And all of a sudden, people wanted to banking to for them to personally get really rich. That was a problem. I think these, you know, the boom bust is how we move forward. Isn't it sad? We have to get to greed, and we have to implode, and then we pull back, and we regulate, and we learn for a while, and then we get greedy again. I don't think you will ever change that. I'm not sure that you can learn not to be greedy. I think what you can learn is to how to regulate.
Isn't that a piece of capitalism? I mean, if you're going to live in a capitalist society, Mark, don't you have to have the financial structure for there to be both meteoric climbs and descents?
Well, I think you do, but I think the society that we have today knows what's illegal and illegal, but I think they forgot about what's right from wrong.
I don't know that the legal-illegal delineation is all that clear in some people's minds.
Even that isn't.
What was right was making money. That's what was right. And the problem is, at what point do you start asking, you made a lot of money, but who got hurt in return? You were able to take on a lot of risk, but who was basically insuring your risk? And that's where regulation has to come back. We were not regulating. We were looking the other way. These people were able to do a lot of things legally. That's the horrific thing, is that this activity wasn't illegal. It wasn't regulated. Now we have to get back to a point where we have to sort of reteach, re-regulate, because they will push the envelope as far as it will go. Well, now someone needs to seal the damn envelope.
But even in capitalism, there is nowhere a principle that anyone would accept that says that you can cheat people, you can trick people, you can fool people, you can have what are allegedly rating services that give you a AAA rating and so on, but they're actually employed by the people whose products they're rating, and they have absolutely no credibility because they are not telling you the truth about a product. That's not capitalism. That never was intended to be, and somehow if that became the rule of the game, that I can create any kind of product, I can sell you something in a jar with a cork in it and say that, what do you got? Oh, you got swollen feet? Well, yeah, it'll cure that. And when the next guy comes along and I say, well, what do you got? My hair is falling out. Well, here it is. This will cure that. You know, we did away with that long ago. That's why we created all of these regulatory agencies and testing services and, you know, the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture Inspection Services, because we said that is not what capitalism is. That is a Wild West, ancient, you know.
But Congress had to be a party to this because, for example, look at derivatives. Didn't we deregulate derivatives around 2000? Wasn't there a senator from Texas that was actually responsible for this? And you can almost see that as a bright line of demarcation. As soon as we decided to say we're going to trust the institution to regulate themselves, then the market went berserk. And everybody lost an ethical compass because they were making too much money. And even some of the investors were making too much money. We all thought that we were going to do well, but you can't do well on a fiction, and you can't do well when you cheat.
Well, I listen to public radio all the time, and I was just listening before this show started. And there was a wonderful discussion, which was that actually a lot of these investment companies decided that they really weren't making very much money by serving their customers. They could make a lot more money by making money for themselves. And so when you started putting your money into investment instruments with these companies, you thought that they were there to help give you advice on how you could maximize your investments. But in fact, the company itself really wasn't much interested in that. And so they created these instruments and then created these other processes where they could bet against their own instruments and make a lot more money. And that certainly the consumer didn't know.
It's not just enough to sell snake oil. You not have to sell the right to bet on who you think will and will not make money off the snake
oil. That's right. Exactly. And so that, I think, and it's complicated to get your hands around. You know, I'm only now beginning to sort of understand why we got to this and how this worked. The average American out there had no idea that was going on and may not even understand right now what it was that was being done. But I think that they're all smart enough to know that this is not something that probably should have been going on, even if it was legal, that this is not in the interest of the consumer, of you know, pension funds. And it just sort of seems un-American, frankly.
Well, can we have a libertarian call in? Because libertarians basically say they want to dismantle government. They don't trust government. They want unfettered capitalism. Well, you know what? The derivatives market was unfettered capitalism. There was no government regulator. There was no regulation. There was no oversight. So, sweetheart, what did that get you? I want a libertarian to address that.
Please. Let's move on to immigration.
We don't have any libertarians here.
Yeah, listen to the show.
There are many libertarians who listen to Iowa Public Radio.
But it's too nice. They're out gardening today. No.
So immigration. The state of Arizona passed a law that makes it a state crime to be in the U.S. illegally, and that local law enforcement have an obligation to ask for documents from someone that they reasonably believe might be someone who is in the country illegally. And if you don't think your local police or sheriff is doing a good job enforcing the law as a citizen, you can sue them. Arnie, let's start with you. What is the national impact of Arizona passing this law?
Well, it's pushing immigration before global warming and climate change, because now we have to address the issue, and maybe that was Arizona's point. And I think the law is horrific. I think that when you hear the president of Mexico basically issuing, you know, a travel warning. Do you know what I did? I sent out an email, I think, to you as well as to Stefan, saying I think the Canadians should issue a travel warning too.
That's right.
I mean, because you might be stopped because you have a Canadian accent.
Well, yeah,
you know?
they're stopped all the time, by the way.
But sort of like in concert with what's going on in Mexico. But let me share something with you. I'm going to recommend an article, because a good friend of mine is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. His name is James Steele. Donald Bartlett and James Steele wrote an article in Time magazine many, many years ago. I think it was 2003. And it was entitled, Illegal Aliens, Who Left the Door Open? And what state did they go to write this?
Arizona.
All right? And when you read this story, I don't care which side of the aisle you are on, you will be physically ill by what Arizona is forced to pay for, to deal with, the complications. And this is really a testament to a federal government that talks about illegal immigration and does nothing. I mean nothing to address it. In fact, it makes the situation worse. So Arizona did something that almost, I hate to say this, reminds me a little bit about Nazi Germany, you know, wearing a star on your arm. But they are also expressing frustration because waiting has not worked. It has not worked for Arizona.
Well, that's right. And the additional problem is that in the United States, both in academia, for example, we have fought like crazy. I'm not talking about myself personally, but generally in academia, we have fought immigration rulings and tight borders and border protection for the last 40 years that I have been an academic. I mean, in academia, there was always this whole thing, there are no such thing as illegal human beings. We don't want to, you know, tighten up the borders and so on. And the Democrats were very lax on this because the Democrats have a huge electoral base in college towns and in liberal academic communities. So this is one group that really, in a way, undermined any robust immigration reform that would tighten up the borders and have the process become a legal process where people have to get permission to come in. And number two, who else? It was a lot of big companies and agriculture who benefited enormously from all this cheap labor, the construction industry, the meatpacking industry. They all really undermined immigration reform. They did it very subtly. It made it almost impossible for the federal government to enact robust immigration rules. And so it's the liberal left and the business community and agriculture who are responsible largely for us having neglected this until it's reached this crisis point.
We've got a good question.
The
problem is, read George Will today, because George Will is really kind of scary, because George Will is defending Arizona's law. And he's talking about the fact that, you know, but they have to reasonably suspect, and they the police have to reasonably act, and this is not going to be because someone has a Mexican accent, or because someone, I mean, this is all going to be done based on a reasonable assumption that someone may, in fact, be undocumented. Can you tell me, how does an undocumented worker act differently than a documented worker? Do they eat different hamburgers? Do they, you know, do they go shop with your left hand and your right hand? What is different about their behavior that would give someone the suspicion that this person is undocumented, unless the only thing you could do is profile?
Well, let's say, Arnie, that you are dark-skinned, short, and look like an indigenous person from the hills of Guatemala, okay? We won't stop you, because we're not allowed to do that. But let's say you happen to be standing on a street corner waiting for a friend of yours to go to get a movie or something, and you're standing on that street corner. Then you're acting suspiciously, Arnie, because people who stand on street corners who are brown and short are there because they're day laborers. So then we can stop you. We can question you. We can say, show me your U.S. residency or citizenship card, and I will have had a legitimate reason. So, Arnie, please don't stop on any street corners, okay?
We've got a good question here from Paul in Des Moines. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, guys. And this question is maybe not, it's almost like a fortune-telling question, but not knowing anything at this point, from a political standpoint, who do you think is going to benefit most in the midterm elections and grabbing those independent voters now based on this issue? Do you think it'll go more towards the Tea Party and Republican types, or do you think that some of these independents will swing more to Democrats at the midterm election? And thank you very much, and I'll take your answers off the air.
Thanks, Paul, for your question. Arnie, what do you think?
I'm glad you picked her first. Because
a couple of things. It is going to motivate a lot of the Hispanic voters in this country to participate in the 2010 election because they are directly impacted. And I mean legal folks who are of Hispanic background, because they are in part of that sort of broad sweep. What does it mean for independent voters? Well, I think what's interesting is you now have John McCain, Tom Tancredo, a number of very, very anti-immigrant spokespeople, not McCain, but Tancredo, for example, saying that this law has gone too far.
Yeah, if Tom Tancredo says that.
Tom Tancredo said that. I almost fell off the chair when I saw this. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because if you are angry about Big Brother, you just put Big Brother on steroids with this bill. This is government out of control.
Well, and if you are a libertarian, you sure as heck are going to just rip your hair out, because this is the far end extreme 1984 Big Brother version of government enforcement. On the other hand, in Arizona, there's a 70% approval rating for this piece of legislation. 70%.
Because they're sick of basically being pawns in this game.
Yeah,
let me just read you something.
Right.
This is from that article from 2003. They're talking about the fact that there's kind of this dance that's being done between the U.S. government and the Mexican government. Listen to this line. Mexico sends its poor north to take jobs illegally, and the U.S. arrests enough of the border crossers to create the illusion that it is enforcing the immigration laws while allowing the great majority to get through. Local lawmen have learned the dance firsthand, and their towns and their counties have had to pay for it. So what Arizona says we are paying big time for your failure to address this issue. We are sick of it. They're not angry at people crossing the border. They're angry at the consequences that they have to pay for.
Well, they're also angry at people crossing the border, Arnie. I mean, because they have had an uncontrolled border in 2010 is no joke, because we are very concerned about terrorists and how they get in here. I mean, we want to have this very tight screening process at airports and so on, and people are pouring across our border without showing papers to anybody. We can't have that. Number two, the drug cartels have taken advantage of this, and a lot of that cross-border illegal traffic is in fact connected to drug organizations. And a lot of the violence that has now occurred afterwards is because People working for the drug cartels are coming back and they're killing off their opponents and so on. And so that drug war from Mexico is actually spilling into Arizona. I mean, my friend in Phoenix tells me that, you know, she's going to go buy a gun because they can now buy a gun and carry it almost anywhere they want. And it's apparently much more than what you're saying. There is actually this sense that this is a very high sort of security problem.
We've got a caller that wants to speak to that point exactly. Armando from Iowa City, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Big fan. I'm actually one of those independent young Latino voters you were speaking about. I'm actually from Texas, but I've been here for 20-some years. But I have a question. I was watching the news the other day on Fox News about how this is supposed to be related to the drug cartel. And from being me from a border town, Laredo, Texas, which mm-hmm. is pretty bad, it's completely different. It's not. That's not how the way you do it. I wouldn't be able to swallow this bill if they would say everybody who gets arrested, everybody who gets pulled over, being a celebrity, sports star, whoever, anybody, mm-hmm. everybody in that state will have to show 2 proofs of ID. I'll be like, you know what? Bad, but okay. They're not saying that.
Yeah.
Well, that guy looks suspicious and Mexican.
Right.
Let's do what we do at airports. At airports, you stop a Norwegian lady, and you stop an Italian man, and you stop a Muslim, and you stop a Jew, and
difference, Arnie. I think there's a difference because, you know, people have made the case that, you know, you have to have a driver's license, you have to have a passport, et cetera. But those are pieces of government-issued identification you need to do something. This in Arizona is talking about having a requirement to have this documentation simply to exist.
The language is that there has to be some reasonable, rational reason for suspecting that this person may in fact be undocumented. My question is, what the H would that be? What would that, I mean, if someone can give me the top 10 reasonable activities that an undocumented worker exhibits that would make someone suspicious, then maybe I could agree with you. But walking down the street, standing on the corner, raking a front lawn, I mean, ask Mitt Romney about his front lawn. You know, he had undocumented workers on his front lawn. He had no reasonable suspicion that people were documented or undocumented. They came to fix his grass.
Armando, you had another question?
Yeah, exactly. Let me look to that exact point. My father's been, we've been here for generations.
Yes.
My dad says that we didn't cross the border, the border crossed us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the point. He's been working construction for 50-some-odd years, and usually he comes home all dirty. And my father has been a typical Mexican-American person you see in the street. He's has a mustache, dark complexion. When he comes home from work, he's dirty. And he if you saw him on the street, he looks illegal. But he's been here for generations. So that's what's we're going backwards, and it's sad.
Well, Armando, let me close by asking you one question though. What do you think the right answer is? Because you know, there are laws that you have to immigrate here legally. But there's also at least some belief in civil liberties that we can't just, you know, pull over every dark-skinned person and make them show papers. What do you think the right answer is on how the U.S. Cracks down on illegal immigration but doing it in a way that doesn't make Hispanics feel threatened?
Exactly. There's a completely different way to do it. Number one, let me just say also that if you thought the cops were going to have a hard time finding cartels, that could be impossible now because nobody would talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
But now, let's say
that's right.
They're going to be in order for two things. You have to stop the cartels. In order to do that, you follow the money. You follow the money. The U.S. has to work with Mexico and the border to stop it. And it's possible, but there's so much money they really don't want to do anything about it. Because there's so much money that goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do that. And then the other thing about this illegal immigration, yes, you have to secure the borders. You have to arrest people and you have to stop them. Now, you have to also say that if you want to be a U.S. citizen, you have to present yourself, sign up, wait in line, and learn English and become accustomed to being an American. And that's possible. People do want to become an American. Me, I'm a Mexican-American, I have still my culture, and I'm still an American, but I have to do it the right way. this is not the right way. This is not, as a human being, this is not right. You have to do it, there's an easy way to do it. You just have to not do it this harsh. You have to stop two things, stop the drugs and money, and then tell everybody who is illegal to come forward. We're not going to take you back. You just have to wait in line for your turn. Pass this test. If you pass it, you become a United States citizen. If you don't, sorry.
Armando, well, thank you. Armando, thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have today on Talk of Iowa. Arnie Artisan, Stephen Schmidt, thank you both. Have a good day. We'll see you next week.
Thank you very much. It was a great show.
Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can send us questions and comments at any time at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan All. Thanks for joining us.